Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics Question Time with me, Alistair Campbell.
And me, Rory Stewart.
Now, Rory, you're interested in this and you understand more about it than I do, so let me kick off with one for you. Jason Palmar, Google's AI, Gemini, has proven very divisive with its altered history. Do you think these AI large language models from Google, OpenAI and X will have a positive, neutral or negative impact on the 2024 elections here and around the world?
Well, let me first do Google Gemini and then I'll hand to you on elections. So, story basically is that OpenAI released in November 22 and now has a very close relationship with Microsoft. And all the time, while OpenAI was bringing together this amazing thing, ChatGPT, that everybody's been using, Google was developing its own model and it was slow to get it out. And there was huge recrimination because basically OpenAI launched, got 100 million users very, very quickly, and Google felt slow and behind the curve. Finally, it released a product called Bard, which was pretty underwhelming. And when it was released, there was a drop in the Google share price. It then spent nearly a year scratching its head and has just released in February, Gemini, which was its new improved version, which was supposed to challenge ChatGPT. And the scandal that immediately broke out is that the guardrails put around it, the way in which it had been protected, meant that if you asked for an image of a medieval British king or a pope, it would show an African American. If you asked for an image of a German soldier during the Second World War, it would show black people in Nazi uniforms. When it was asked who was worse, Elon Musk or Adolf Hitler, it said, well, that's a very difficult question to answer because Elon Musk has sent some quite offensive tweets. And on the other hand, Adolf Hitler did kill millions of people. And when asked whether it would be okay to misgender Caitlyn Jenner in order to avert a thermonuclear war, it said, under no conditions can you misgender Caitlyn Jenner. So in other words, the scandal was that there is what people have referred to as sort of extreme woke setting. And it led essentially to the product being withdrawn, Google's share price again dropping, and huge recriminations within Google, leaving ChatGPT with a pretty open field at the moment as people struggle to develop challenges. Over to you on what impact you think any of these AI platforms might have on elections.
I think they're already having an impact. And the truth is that we don't necessarily know what it is because a lot of it is happening away from the public gaze. But this is going to be the first election year where AI is a kind of a factor in these elections. And it's happening at a time when, you know, in many of the countries that are holding elections, we don't have necessarily politicians who will want to sort of stand up against this together. We have a lot of politicians who are going to use and abuse any possible opportunity that they have. So I think that there will be an impact as to whether it's positive, neutral, or negative. I suspect unless it's all done out in the open, it will be negative.
It will be negative, won't it? And we've talked about this a little bit, haven't we? I remember, you know, I particularly talked about my experience running to be Mayor of London and seeing these companies come and pitch me on all the tricks they could get up to with social media and all they'd done for elections in the past. And the sense that if you're really behind in the polls or you're not even behind, but really struggling to win an election, the temptation, if somebody comes along and offers some fancy AI package as a way of negative campaigning against your opponent, besmirching them, or developing your own group of fanatical supporters, it'll be very tempting for people to say yes. And we are in this, not just the big year of elections, we're in this absolutely critical year between the moment where AI is being developed and the moment where regulation will actually come into force. Real regulation on AI is not likely to come into force till 2025. So this is almost the worst possible year for this stuff.
Well, and also if you think that one of the panels I was at the Adelaide Festival, there was somebody was speaking about this issue in relation to the American election. If you think that Trump has been able to persuade kind of roughly sort of 4 out of 10 Americans that something which you and I know to be completely untrue, namely the election was stolen from him, just by the sheer force of his kind of communication skills and personality and endless repetition through social media and so forth, he's been able to have that level of persuasion. What these large language models give you is the ability to do the elements of persuasion that you're using them are done on a completely different scale.
And with a much more personalized, much more precise, you can really tailor the conspiracy theory to the individual. You can adapt and create a huge, Yuval Noah Harari, who we interviewed on Leading, says AI is the perfect way of creating a sort of QAnon conspiracy to the power of 1,000. I mean, QAnon being this conspiracy that kind of links Hillary Clinton to child sex abuse and all this kind of stuff, which is important in bits of the far right in the States. But ChatGPT can really generate conspiracy theories because it will know for each individual what our vulnerabilities are, what kind of weird information and footnotes we'd like to convince ourselves of it.
I heard my favorite German podcast, Acht Milliarden, this week they were talking about Chinese cyber hacking and all these major, major private companies that are basically engaged in, you know, stuff that we would define as espionage, but they're sort of doing it as private companies, but they're doing it, as it were, as patriots on behalf of the state. And interestingly, before I came out to Australia, I was speaking at the launch of this thing, the Soft Power Index, and US is still number one, UK is number two, but the big shift has been China displacing Japan and Germany. And this is a big, big survey done around the world of how other people in other countries see every country in the world. And what's interesting, I think, is that, and this is what we talked to Jamie Rubin about, is that essentially the success of China's diplomatic rise, which we argue would be related more to soft power, actually is a form of hard power, because they're using a lot of this, you know, very modern systematic propagandizing for their own policies and values and against those of America and the other democracies. And it shows that this showed to me that it's having an effect. That you'd think that the sort of sense of China around the world maybe wasn't that positive, but it's actually they're going up while Japan and Germany are going down.
Yeah, and really investing. I mean, all these countries investing strongly in traditional media, I mean, in foreign language broadcasting. But as long ago as 2017, an investigation in the US suggested that China employed between 50 and 100,000 personnel in the government just to do cyber attacks and cyber warfare. And AI essentially provides the potential to mount those attacks far, far more quickly, to learn from every attack what defeated it and to adapt and do it again. And it also changed the shape of politics, because we haven't begun to talk enough on the podcast, but just the profound implication on employment, just all the jobs which are going to be replaced by AI. Just to give, you know, one small example, we often talk about the obvious places. So, you know, software development is now takes 95% less time than it used to. So you'd either employ 1/20th of the number of software developers, or you'd make 20 times as much software. Call centers will go. But it's also things like Shoshana's working, as you know, in Afghanistan on doing traditional craft stuff. And there's not much use anymore for shooting shots for interior design or fashion magazines in the way that you used to with studios and photographers, because actually the AI can now simply generate itself the images that you need for your brochures. Whole elements of the creative industry are going to go very quickly. And the implications for developing new drugs, new medicines, because AI will be able to experiment with different chemical formula far more quickly than anything in the past. But not just drugs and organic chemistry, but also inorganic. It'll be able to generate new materials, both negatively, you know, new weapons, positively, new materials that could be life-saving.
Now, maybe related to the whole misuse of these new technologies. Portuguese far right, Marcos Reed. What do you make of André Ventura and the Chega party in Portugal? Is this yet another European country where the far right are on the rise? Well, he does seem to be. This is this guy, Ventura, 41, pretty colourful past. And this is an election in Portugal caused by the resignation of the... We'd just been talking about how he was sort of bucking the trend on all the difficulties that most European leaders were facing. But António Costa resigned over a corruption scandal that he wasn't personally necessarily at the centre of, but he felt he had to take responsibility. He's resigned. They've got an election. And at the moment, Chega, which is Portuguese for enough, are riding pretty well. They're in third place in the polls and using a lot of the right-wing tactics that we've seen.
Well, the amazing thing about it is that I was on record on the podcast saying that I thought Portugal was the exception to populism in Europe, and partly because Portuguese population's traditionally much more relaxed about immigration. I mean, there have been polls suggesting 80% of the Portuguese population in favor of immigration, complete outlier in Europe, and hasn't really had a populist tradition since the 1970s, since its democracy got going, since the Salazar dictatorship went. And suddenly this thing has emerged. So he founded the party in 2019. He had 1.9% of the vote then. By 2022, 7.3%. Now looks like he's going to be getting over 20% of the vote. So that's from a standing start in 4 years. And, you know, he's Christian, anti-Islamist, Eurosceptic, part of this international group. I mean, he's reaching out to Matteo Salvini in Italy. And it's really making me think that no country is really immune from this. And I'm afraid Ireland too, where we also, you know, often, partly because you're very fond of Ireland, and I really enjoyed going to Ireland with you, praise its politics, praise its sort of apparently sensible, moderate politicians. But there too, Sinn Féin, which is very much a pretty radical populist party, is on the rise and looks like it could well sweep these guys aside in the next election.
Yeah, I wonder whether we've talked before about Morgan McSweeney, who's running Labour strategy, and he keeps sending these graphs around to candidates and campaigners, which show how volatile polls can be. I don't know if you can see, Rory, that's a tracking poll on the Portuguese scene. And if you can see the line there of the Socialist Party since the scandal, it's gone down and down and down and down. And it hasn't really been the benefit of the main conservative opposition. It's the Chega line that is going up and up and up and up. So, yeah, Portugal, one to watch. Rory, what about this one? Giving the vote to prisoners, Mrs. H. She's obviously a teacher. I've just taught my Year 12 politics class about extending the franchise, in particular giving the vote to prisoners. And I said I'd ask, do you think this should be considered? And if so, why?
100%. I have always thought the prisoners should vote. I believe everybody should have the vote. And I think one of the reasons is that our conditions in prisons are disgusting and inhumane. And if prisoners don't vote, you're removing one of the main mechanisms for accountability to make politicians focus on those conditions. I never understood it. I mean, David Cameron was completely against votes for prisoners and said, I think in the House of Commons, that he was kind of sickened to his heart because the European Court of Human Rights was suggesting that prisoners should have the vote. I don't get it. I don't get why any citizen should be deprived of the vote.
But I agree. I think part of what prisons are meant to be is about, you know, trying to rehabilitate, trying to get people who will at least think about reintegrating into society when they get out. And the other thing is, you know, prisoners have a lot of time on their hands, and I've been in prisons where you could have some really interesting conversations about politics. So no, I'd be with you on that. And given that, you know, the numbers aren't so large that you're not going to have an election that is, as it were, swung by the convict vote. But I can see why. I don't know why David Cameron felt so strongly. Probably he just felt that there'd be a kind of horrible right wing reaction against him. Against him, if he even thought about doing it.
Donna Mooney, following up on this, prisons.
Go on.
Can you please discuss IPP prison sentences? Lords will be debating amendments. The victims and prisoners bill on the 12th of March decide which ones should go forward. One of the things we'll be highlighting to them is that there have been 9 suicides by those serving IPP last year in prison, the highest number ever since the IPP was introduced. So just to remind people of this is this absolutely barbaric system which was introduced, I'm afraid, by David Blunkett under New Labour, and which, although the Conservatives stopped sending people convicting them. They haven't released the people under these sentences. These are indefinite sentences. So somebody could have committed a pretty minor crime, and then they're put away, or were put away indefinitely. And when they're released, they can be recalled at almost any time for a minor breach. And the impact on mental health is very extreme, hence the 9 suicides. And we really should, all parties, be committing to getting rid of these sentences. The reason why it doesn't happen is ministers are always scared that one of these people may go on and commit some crime and then they'll be accused of it. Given that this form of sentencing hasn't happened for 14 years, we should deal with the historical injustice.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. Okay, Rory, loads more questions to come. Let's have a quick break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
PMQs twice a week. Max Pearson, do you think the House of Commons would be better off if PMQs was to return to twice a week? It would take away the need for politicians to use it as their only chance to get a good headline and maybe increase proper scrutiny. I mean, I guess I should take that on because, of course, it was Tony Blair who persuaded Betty Boothroyd, then Speaker of the House, that we should move from 2 15-minute sessions a week to 1 half-an-hour session. And the thinking genuinely was that 15 minutes wasn't very long, and also it did tie up the diary for 2 days and with all the preparation time and so forth. But you know, here in Australia, Rory, and it's the same, I think, in Ireland, they have question time every day that Parliament's sitting, and the whole cabinet sits there and has to take questions. It's a very, you know, it's a really, really time-consuming thing. But what do you think? Did you ever think Prime Minister's question was anything other than a bit of a pantomime?
So I wanted really strong, I don't care whether it's once a week or twice a week, but I really wanted a strong distinction between what I'd like, which was a serious national, international PMQs divided from, would the Prime Minister please congratulate my local football team on their fantastic performance or say hello to the primary school in my constituency? I got so cross about that. You know, you turn up thinking there's some massive national or international scandal and all you get is, well, right honourable member would like to know that I visited Twiddledum's pet home in my constituency last week and Snooky the Spaniel wanted to say hello. And then the Prime Minister will be like, please give my very best to Snooky the Spaniel. So I'd like to see Keir Starmer say, okay, we can have 1 week where you're allowed to do press releases for your constituency of that sort, and then another week where you're only allowed to ask serious questions or we'll boo you.
Mm. It's you know what's really interesting? I watched Question Time in the Australian Parliament the other day. And so they have, the chamber's sort of different to ours. The speaker sits down. He doesn't sort of jump up and down. There's a lot of sledging. It's less noisy than the House of Commons, but there's a lot of sledging going on, you know, sort
What's
of
sledging?
Insults. You know, like insults flying around. And the speaker gives this constant running commentary. You know, will the member, that's a warning, one more time and you're out, and that's all going the whole time. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister sits at one side of the table, the Leader of the Opposition, Dutton, sits at the other, and they're there just for the whole thing. It goes on for ages, and the MPs can ask questions of any minister who's in the House, so they all sort of troop up. The Prime Minister doesn't actually answer that many questions. But the other thing that goes on is on the Labour side, and I'm seeing some of the Prime Minister's team tomorrow, and I'm going to say this honestly: all they do is these kind of, you know, my question is for the Minister for Work and or the Minister of Employment. What will the Albanese tax program do to benefit the women in my constituency? And then the minister stands up and says, well, I know she cares about this issue because the reason she won her seat is she campaigned so hard on this issue and she really cares for the people at their jobs, etc. And what our tax-cutting agenda is going to do is
blimey.
And then the other side, they had a message that they wanted to get over. They've got this campaign going, which is, I'm afraid, it looks to me like a bit of post-truth. But they're basically saying that it's back onto the kind of net zero stuff, that the government is going to force up the price of a Toyota or a Hyundai or so-and-so. So they all get up and ask the same question. Very good climate change minister, I have to say. He got up and sort of smacked them all around the place. But it's just sort of, after a while I was thinking, God, is it like this every day? So I asked some of the MPs, is it like this every day? And they said, yeah, it is. So well, definitely not every day. Like once a week, twice a week, but please not every day.
No, they're absolutely, absolutely terrible. So why do dictators have elections? Chris Salmon, why do dictators like Putin feel the need to have general elections? Well, the first thing to say is that Putin came in with an election. And usually with most authoritarian rulers, their first election is fairer than their later elections. But once you've come with an election, it's pretty difficult to stop holding elections. When you keep rolling with them, even when you're pretty authoritarian, you do it partly because there is a shred of legitimacy. It's quite difficult to just refuse to have any elections at all. So that shred of legitimacy gives you an opportunity to go out in public. The campaigning allows you to mobilize a bit of public support, allows you to do a little bit to discredit and screw with the opposition. So you can usually use an election to disqualify opposition candidates, humiliate them in public. You can use it to split your own supporters in weird ways. But it's not obviously about you risking losing power. It's about you doing a sort of strange pantomime bit of mobilization. But the thing that nobody must ever forget is that in a way, an authoritarian state is equally worried about public opinion because, of course, they're terrified about revolutions and coup d'etats. And so this is part of their general process of trying to make sure that they're not toppled.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the elections that we've had this week in Iran, which is a, you know, theocracy form of dictatorship. And it's interesting, even though, you know, the hardliners have won a massive majority, as was completely expected, because most of the people who weren't hardliners weren't allowed to run. But there was the turnout was the lowest it's ever been, which of itself is quite interesting. So there is a significance to that. And also there were apparently 5% of the ballot papers were spoilt, which again is sort of interesting.
I'm glad you've raised that. We should do a little bit on the Iranian elections because actually Iran is unusual there. The elections in Iran often do throw up strange things. And sometimes the clerics have been defeated and more liberal candidates have come through. I mean, every different regime has a different attitude towards these kinds of things and how much freedom they allow. And that's partly to do with how confident they're feeling. I mean, I remember when the Emmerson Mnangagwa, who took over from Mugabe in Zimbabwe, held his first elections. He was pretty confident that he was going to win, but he still really went out of his way to make sure that the opposition was disadvantaged in every way they possibly could be.
Mm. But I mean, the Iranian elections is interesting. So the president went out and said thank you and said what a passionate turnout and said that the result was overwhelming, massive blow to opponents of the Islamic Republic. But then immediately, and even though, you know, you might worry, think that there's no freedom of speech and so forth, but there's this thing called the Reform Front Coalition. And they refused to take part in the election because they said it was utterly meaningless. And her line was that she hoped that the low turnout and the spoilt ballot papers were a lesson for the state. And she talked about a silent majority that is not happy with what's happening in the country. So it was, I guess, you know, the question is right that there's a pointlessness on one level. It's just the dictator, certainly when we see Putin's election. I mean, he will have all the panoply of a normal election. He'll have rallies. He'll have, you know, he'll probably throw up some puppet to have a debate with. He'll pretend to be questioned by sort of independent media. And it'll just be a pantomime. But and then he'll win and the world will move on. But I think actually what's happened in Iran in recent days is more significant just than the, oh, look, they won because they were always going to. What about this one, Rory? Mark, does Ofcom need reforming?
Well, we know what you think about that one. And I think part of this is about the story around GB News. So, kind of tell us about your views on GB News and Ofcom.
Well, I don't really like talking about GB News because I think on one level they're absurd, but I think they are part of the undermining of the democratic institutions on which our democracy depends. And, you know, we always prided ourselves. We used to look at American television and think, you know, at least we're never going to go down that track. And they're taking us down that track. But they're only doing it because they can. They're doing it because the government is enabling them. You know, the fact that Jeremy Hunt, I mean, as you said earlier, Jeremy Hunt's sort of one of the serious people, as it were. But, you know, he did his first big interview as Chancellor on GB News. You have Ofcom saying it's not a news channel and it's called GB News, for God's sake.
Yeah, and the reason they say that is that that avoids them regulating, isn't it? If it's a news channel, it has to be regulated in a different way.
Exactly. So they can pretend that it's something else. And okay, it's not a news channel and it's not telling the news in the way that BBC, Sky, etc. do. But it is a news channel. It exists
And it's also providing £600,000 a year of salary increases to Tory MPs. So it's also a sort of strange way of providing subsidies to Tory MPs who tend to be from the right of the party. Yeah.
Where it's positioning itself, and of course it has Farage on there as well, where it's positioning itself is, assuming that Labour win and the Tories lose, as a big player within the leadership contest to follow. So they're all sort of parading their goods on there. We had a lot of feedback last week after we discussed very briefly Paul Marshall, the guy that's in, you know, one of the big funders of this thing. And it is interesting, a bit like Lee Anderson. It's weird, isn't it, how the people who travel from left to right often are the kind of most dangerously anti-democratic people in their actions. So there's Anderson, who was kind of militant Labour, and he's now right out in the far right, and Paul Marshall, who wanted to be a Lib Dem MP, and now he's funding this thing. He's also involved in schools, he's involved in the church. You know, these are people who operate under the radar, and I think we need to get them out above the radar so that people can really know who and what they are. So Ofcom, I don't know what they do. I don't know what Ofcom does, but it is clearly not operating in a way that it should be, and it is not fit for purpose.
And possibly, you know, one of the allegations in the past has been that it's sort of frightened and intimidated by government. Boris Johnson tried to leverage in your old friend, the editor of the Daily Mail, as the head of Ofcom, didn't he, at one point?
And then the other person they had in mind was Charles Moore. I mean, you know, it's all part of this. And listen, the one thing the Tories and the right generally around the world have been very, very good at is getting the people that they want into places on quangos, onto commissions and so forth.
So that's really interesting. So just on that one, I mean, it was a very live issue when I was a Tory MP, because of course what they felt was that Labour had been unbelievably good at getting everyone into the institutions.
I don't think we were. I sometimes felt we were far too sensitive.
Oh, well, no, their sense, I remember, you know, people like Matt Hancock talked about this all the time. Their sense was that Labour had been brilliant at it, and they would use this phrase, the march through the institutions, which I think is a Trotskyite phrase.
Oh, right. Well, God, I wish we had.
And so you have this weird world where, on the one hand, from your point of view, a lot of these institutions are being taken over by right-wingers. But of course, for the real right, they think that everything from the BBC through to Ofcom or whatever are just run by a bunch of kind of soft lefties. So people like me are very much seen as kind of, you know, if I were ever to end up connected to one of these organizations, that would immediately be seen by the right as another part of the kind of betrayal to the kind of Blairite blob, which they think runs everything. Okay, aging population. David, with almost every issue in politics, we keep hearing that the aging population has or will have an effect. How big an issue is the aging population? Is it just a minor issue, or is it a huge future issue nobody is really tackling? It is the most enormous issue. I mean, in every conceivable way. You know, when Lloyd George started the old age pension, there was one retired person, I think, for something like every 20 working people. There's now 3 working people for every 1 retired person. So that's the first way that it matters. There's fewer and fewer working people paying for older people. And as life expectancy increases, that's what puts the massive burden on the NHS. You know, the NHS, somebody pointed out to us, was, I think, 27% of the government budget when Gordon Brown came in, and is now 45% of the government budget. Sajid Javid, in fact, pointed that out to me on Leading.
We discussed this, didn't we, with Sajid Javid, and I think we were making the point that a lot of the reason why we were able, as New Labour, to get so much money into the health service was in part because the sort of defence peace dividend was playing out. And, of course, that's going to be reversed. And the other thing, I just looked at, just after you read the question, I looked up this another graph for you to look at. there's a graph, there's the graph of the British, the UK birth rate. So it's gone from 3 in the mid 60s, late 70s, 3 births per woman, down to, you know, substantially now below 2. So we're talking about fewer people being born and more people living to a very, very old age, with often with very long-term, expensive healthcare issues.
And increasingly dependent, obviously, therefore, on younger people to look after,
to look after them.
Which means immigration, and means bringing more people into the United Kingdom in order to do those jobs. And that, of course, touches on productivity, because many of those people are coming to the UK as adults. So a lot of the models that we have around the fact that education, vocational training is going to define the new generation may not be true, because some people may be coming set up. Housing, again, the old people tend to own the houses, the young people don't. Voting, old people vote much more. As you keep pointing out, young people don't vote very much. So the politics is skewed.
Another reason why we should have compulsory voting. Sajid Javid was pretty clear on the health question, wasn't he? I was quite surprised by how kind of out there he was about it, that essentially he thought that the NHS, the current funding model, was going to have to change. And I wonder whether he thought there was a sort of Nixon goes to China sense of he thinks that maybe only a Labour government could do that.
Well, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? I mean, one of the things he suggested, which I'm completely obsessed with, is the idea of Keir Starmer coming in and setting up a proper cross-party independent commission on the NHS, which could come up with some ideas which could last beyond parties and beyond governments, because it really needs to be taken out of the political sphere. It needs to be sorted for 10 or 20 years. There have been, as you can imagine, hundreds of papers written about what to do about the NHS. We've got very, very clear ideas on what kind of things need to happen, but there's just a total lack of political courage to drive it through, because everybody's worried that the other political party is going to stab them in the back if they try. Mm.
Now, what about this one, Rory? Maybe we can have a guessing game on this one. This is from Andy Jennings. My local MP is increasingly impressive on global and national issues, but is very weak as a constituency MP. How do I handle this ahead of the general election? Who do you reckon that is then? Somebody, because there are
George,
that many.
It's George Galloway, isn't
it? Oh, get lost. I mean, who do we know who's increasingly impressive on global and national issues?
So the Conservative Party, of course, we sort of tend to think of people like Tobias Elwood doing a lot of stuff on foreign issues, but I don't know whether that, I'm sure he'd say that he's a good local constituency MP.
Yeah. I think, Andy, you have to name names on that one. Send us another question next week and tell us who we're talking about. Then we can make a judgment. But my general advice, Andy, would be to, if it's a Conservative, vote for whoever's closest likely to win. And if it's a Labour MP, just, well, you know, just focus on the fact that they're increasingly impressive and vote Labour, surely.
Okay, final question, I think, from me. As we wait for the Academy Awards, what were your 2023 favourite movies? So my favourite one, which I raised yesterday, but I've just been rewatching, is this amazing documentary on Otto Baxter, Not an Effing Horror Movie, which is directed and written by somebody with Down syndrome.
Oh, yeah. And is that up for any awards?
I don't know what it's any for awards. No, I don't know what it is, but it's just mesmerising. And Otto Baxter himself is just such a strange, attractive, challenging character. It's so moving about his relationship with his birth mother, who gave him away for adoption, how he thinks about that. And I it's really moving and wonderful. Movie for
we
you.
All, but just before I reveal my Oscar choices, we got a lot of feedback from our brief discussion last week about, you were talking about your sister with Down syndrome and other special educational needs. And I don't know if you noticed, David Davis had a huge piece in The Sun on this very issue, which actually I thought was pretty impressive and helpful. And also, I've talked before about, in fact, the woman who asked the question last week, Sam Carlisle, she bumped into Ed Balls at the House of Commons and said, you know, you lot don't do enough about, on Good Morning Britain, you don't do enough about special education needs. And fair play to Ed. Within a couple of days, there was a big thing there, because I do think it's an issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention. It won't win, because I think Oppenheimer is going to win. But I think Anatomy of a Fall should sweep the board at the Oscars. That, to me, was the most impressive film last year.
Great. Well, Alistair, I think on that we should call it a wrap. And thank you very much.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.